Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know, sometimes we look at legal history and, well, can feel a bit dry.
A bit, yeah.
But today, we are plunging into a case that is anything but. It's got a shipwreck, starvation, a truly horrific act of desperation.
And a legal ruling that forces us to question the absolute limits of survival.
We are tackling the Queen versus Dudley and Stevens from 1884.
This is one of those cornerstone cases, and the source material itself, the judgment, it's just brutal to read. Our mission today is to try and cut through that suffering to understand the cold, hard line the law drew.
Right.
The core tension is this. Can extreme, undeniable necessity, I mean, the certainty of death, ever legally justify taking an innocent life?
That is the ultimate question. And the court, they even called it a situation of terrible temptation. So our goal is to explore the facts the jury found and then the legal logic the judges used to get to this really uncompromising conclusion.
Okay, let's get into it. And what makes this case so precise and so painful is the jury's special verdict.
Right, and for anyone who's not familiar, can you explain what that is?
Sure. A special verdict is where the jury doesn't decide guilt or innocence. They just state the undisputed facts of the case. That's it. And they leave the final application of the law entirely up to the judges.
So they're just saying, here's exactly what happened.
Exactly. And the facts they laid out, well, it's a timeline of a descent into hell. It all starts with four English seamen, Thomas Dudley and Edward Stevens. They're the ones on trial. A man named Brooks and the youngest, Richard Parker.
And Parker was just a boy, really, 17, maybe 18 years old.
Right. Their yacht, the Mignonette, it sank in a storm. This was July 5th, 1884. They end up in a tiny open boat stranded about 1,600 miles from land.
1,600 miles. I mean, that alone is basically a death sentence.
It is. Their supplies were pitiful.
Mm-hmm.
They had 2 1-pound tins of turnips.
That's it.
That was it. And they were gone in 3 days. They did catch a small turtle on the fourth day, which, you know, it kept them going for a few more days.
But they can't last long.
No. By day 12, the turtle was completely gone. And this is where the clock really starts ticking. For the next 8 days, they had zero food.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. Their only water was whatever tiny amount of rainwater they could catch in their oilskin capes.
Just imagine that reality. You're completely isolated, starving. So by day 18, things must have been at a breaking point.
They were. 7 days with no food, 5 with no water. And Dudley, who is the captain, he suggests to Stevens and Brooks that, quote, someone should be sacrificed to save the rest.
Wow. And how did the others react to that?
Well, Brooks immediately said no. He dissented. And critically, the boy, Parker, was already in the worst shape. He was weak from drinking seawater.
And he wasn't even consulted.
Not at all. They waited another 6 days. Now we're near the end of July. Dudley brings up drawing lots, you know, to make it fair.
But Brooks refused that too.
He refused to consent, so no lots were drawn. At that point, Dudley and Stephen started talking privately. They decided it should be the boy. He was weaker, and he had no family, no dependents waiting for him.
They were making a calculation.
A terrible one. On July 25th, day 20 of the ordeal, they did it. Richard Parker was lying helpless at the bottom of the boat. Dudley offered a prayer, signaled to Stevens, and then he killed Parker with a penknife.
God. Stevens assented, but Brooks, he still dissented.
He did. He refused to be part of it, though he did later partake of the remains.
And the awful irony is that it worked, at least for a while.
It did. The three men fed on the body and blood of the boy for 4 days, and on the fourth day after the act, a passing vessel rescued them.
The timing is just. It's cruelly precise. If they had waited one more day.
Maybe. And that timing brings us to the key legal findings from the jury. This is essential. The jury found that if the men had not eaten the boy, they would probably not have survived. They would have died in those 4 days.
So physically speaking, the necessity was proven. They did it to survive.
Right. And the jury also noted that the boy, Parker, was weaker and likely to have died before them anyway.
On the surface, that sounds like a slam dunk necessity defense.
It sounds like it until you get to the last two findings. The jury found there was, and I'm quoting, no appreciable chance of saving life except by killing someone for the others to eat.
Okay, that still sounds like necessity.
But then, and this is the killer line, they also concluded there was no greater necessity for killing the boy than any of the other three men.
Ah. So they chose him. It wasn't that they had to choose him. That changes everything.
It changes everything. It moves the action from, you know, an unavoidable act of nature to a deliberate human choice. And that puts Dudley and Stevens in the legal dock.
So let's pivot to that legal battle.
Mm.
With these awful facts, How on earth did the defense try to argue that this wasn't a crime?
They built their entire case around one concept, necessity, and the fundamental principle of self-preservation. They argued this wasn't malicious. This was an act committed under pressure so extreme that it should legally excuse the crime.
And they had some big philosophical names to back that up, right?
They did. They cited casuists, you know, thinkers who specialize in moral dilemmas. The big one was Lord Bacon.
The famous plank example.
That's the one. Two drowning men, one plank big enough for only one. Bacon argued that the survivor who shoves the other off could not be subjected to legal punishment. He called it excusable through unavoidable necessity.
So the argument is, if you're faced with a choice between two certain deaths, your own or an innocent person's, and you choose to save yourself, the law should just look the other way.
That is the core of their claim. It's an appeal to raw human instinct. They were basically saying the law can't expect superhuman heroism from men who are literally starving to death.
But the Crown, they had to push back. How did they counter that argument?
The Crown's rebuttal was, well, it was extremely clear and very narrow. They argued that necessity, in the legal sense, only excuses taking a life in self-defense.
Meaning you're defending yourself against the person you killed.
Exactly. Against their acts. Parker was helpless. He wasn't an aggressor. He was a victim of the very same circumstances.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. And the Crown hammered this home with a comparison to property crimes. They said, look, if the men had stolen the boy's food, it would be theft. Killing him to get his body as food. Well, that's murder. You can't just upgrade the crime because the stakes are higher.
That's a short piece of logic.
Yeah.
And the defense also tried some procedural stuff, right? Jurisdiction.
They did. A bit of a distraction, really. They argued the court didn't have jurisdiction since it happened in the middle of the ocean, but the court shot that down quickly. Under maritime law, English courts had full jurisdiction over British sailors on what was left of a British vessel. So they cleared the deck for the one question that mattered: the principle of necessity.
And that brings us to the ruling from Lord Coleridge, the Chief Justice. This is the part that made the case so famous. He just systematically dismantled the defense.
Devastatingly. He called their argument dangerous, immoral, and opposed to all legal principle and analogy. He drew this very thick, very bright line.
And what was that line?
He said that the type of necessity that justifies homicide is strictly limited to self-defense against an aggressor, period.
So, killing someone who was attacking you versus choosing an innocent victim to satisfy your own need.
Precisely. And he backed this up with centuries of precedent, relying heavily on a text called Lord Hale's Pleas of the Crown. Hale explicitly stated that a man ought rather to die himself than kill an innocent.
The law is setting an incredibly high moral bar there.
An almost impossible one. And that connection to property crime that the Crown made, Lord Coleridge ran with it.
How so?
Lord Hale had already established that extreme hunger does not justify theft in England. So Coleridge made this brilliant extension of that logic.
Right.
He basically said, if the necessity of hunger can't even excuse stealing a loaf of bread, how could it possibly excuse the murder of a human being?
Wow. That just, it completely shuts the door on the defense.
It totally undermines Lord Bacon's plank analogy, which the court officially rejected as not sound law. The court's conclusion was unanimous and firm. The temptation the men faced was not what the law calls necessity. The killing of Richard Parker was legally willful murder.
And this is where the ruling really goes beyond the technical details and into, I guess, morality?
It does. The court acknowledged the terrible suffering. They weren't blind to it, but they stressed that an absolute divorce of law from morality would be a fatal consequence. They weren't just judging these two men. They were defending the very idea of a civil society.
And they started talking about this idea of a duty to die.
Yes. Paradoxically, they argued that the highest duty might be to sacrifice your life, not preserve it at any cost.
They're demanding heroism. It's an incredible standard to set.
It is. They brought up historical examples like the soldiers on the sinking troop ship Birkenhead who stood fast and died so women and children could get into the lifeboats.
I remember that quote from the judgment. Something in Latin.
Necess est ut em, non ut vivem. It is necessary that I go, not that I live.
That's profound. It's saying that civilization itself places the sanctity of innocent life above your own instinct for self-preservation.
And they explained why. They articulated the fundamental danger of this defense, which they called the tyrant's plea.
The tyrant's plea. What does that mean?
It means if you allow necessity as a defense, who gets to be the judge of that necessity? By what standard do you measure the value of lives? Is it strength? intellect, age.
The minute you allow private judgment to override the law on something that fundamental,
yeah,
you get anarchy.
Exactly. There's a note from another justice on the panel, Justice Grove, that captured this perfectly. He said if killing Parker was justified, then later on, two of the three survivors would be justified in killing the third.
And then the strongest would be justified in killing the weakest.
It creates a cascading justification for murder that destroys the entire foundation of legal protection.
So the court's role was to stand firm, no matter how sympathetic the case was. Having affirmed that standard, what happened to Dudley and Stevens?
The law was upheld. The court found them guilty of murder and passed the mandatory sentence of death.
A harsh ruling, but one they felt was necessary to affirm the principle.
Absolutely necessary for the principle. But this is where you see the balance between law and compassion. Even though the court established there was no legal defense, the sentence was later commuted by the Crown.
To what?
To 6 months imprisonment.
Only 6 months. So it's a fascinating split, isn't it? The judicial system affirms the absolute moral standard, but the executive, the Crown, applies mercy for the human weakness.
That is the ultimate takeaway here. Dudley and Stevens established definitively that private necessity hunger, self-preservation, is not a defense for murdering an innocent person in common law. The law remained absolute, but humanity offered mercy.
And that contrast leads us to a final thought for you to carry with you. The judges themselves, they admitted in their ruling that they are often compelled to set up standards we cannot reach ourselves. Mm. This case forces us to confront that paradox. Society, through its laws, demands an almost impossible moral standard, the duty to die rather than kill an innocent, in order to sustain the framework that protects us all. So what does it imply about us, about the purpose of law, that we uphold rules we suspect most people, under that ultimate test, would probably break?
A difficult question.
Think about that balance of law, morality, and compassion until our next deep dive.